supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm producer Alexis Landis, filling in for the esteemed Mike McGrath as we go back and enjoy some of our favorite interviews in this summer special edition of You Bet Your Garden. Joining me is associate producer Brett Rader. Welcome, Brett.
Hi, Alexis. It's great to be here.
We're going to start off the show with an interview Mike did with author Maya Moore, who wrote a beautiful book called The Rose Garden of Fukushima. This is a really touching story of a man who nurtured a rose out of the darkness of the disaster that occurred at the Fukushima nuclear plant in Japan back in 2011. Let's listen.
Maya, thanks so much for coming into You Bet Your Garden today.
Thanks. Such a pleasure to be here on this program. Thank you.
Well, it's a mixed pleasure because This is one of the most beautiful gardening books I've seen, and it is one of the saddest gardening books I've ever seen. I should warn our listeners, this could easily turn into a 6 Kleenex special here.
Yes, it is. I mean, it is about Fukushima. So if anybody knows what Fukushima stands for, it's they had that huge nuclear meltdown on 3/12, actually, 2011.
But in the book, that's one thing that jumped out at me right away. The book is mostly fabulous pictures, and I'll just spoiler alert, of a garden that is totally lost to the world now.
That's right.
But in the preface to the wonderful photos of these magnificent roses, you talk about 3/11.
Mm-hmm.
I think to put it in perspective, our 9/11 is your 3/11.
I think that, yeah, I think you're right. It's a good comparison, I think.
And I remember seeing it on TV, and I remember watching the live footage and seeing a building get up and walk. And I was thinking to myself, no, that's not how it happens, because we've seen so many science fiction movies where waves come in and destroy a city. And I'm thinking, no, that doesn't even look real.
Mm-hmm.
And then I realized, oh, my God, this is happening live.
Right. Well, one of the things that was so incredible about 3/11, the grand, great earthquake of Tohoku, was you saw the images of the tsunami pushing away buildings, cars, ships, boats. And, of course, there were no images, but there were people there, too, of course. So I think the outpour of support that came to Japan right after 3/11 was incredible. And although I'm not Japanese, I would like to thank the whole world for all the support that people showed to Japan right after that. But the thing about this story is it's about Fukushima. There's nothing you can see. Radiation is a clear poison that nobody can see, and it's very hard to fathom the kind of devastation that it brings. It's not like a tsunami where you see buildings being pushed away by waves. You don't see anything. So this story really struck me because this is something that you can actually see, the beautiful roses and so forth. So it's a really, I guess it's, I don't know if it's the right word, but a very effective way to show radiation and the devastation that it brings about.
Now, take us back to the 1960s. As you point out in the book, Japan still has not recovered from World War II. There's still food shortages, there's housing shortages, probably still a low level of employment. This is before Made in Japan turned into a gold star instead of a tarnished star.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it's incomprehensible that a teenage boy falls in love with roses in this culture.
That's right.
Which are not a Japanese plant.
No, not at all. And it's only 15 years after World War II, so Japan was very, very devastated. It was very, very poor in that way. And so people were really much more interested in finding food sources than anything about flowers. And you're right, roses were the ultimate superfluous flower, you know, of them all, because it's so complicated. But I think it was this 17-year-old Katz Okada just fell in love with him, and it wasn't logical. If he thought logically, he would never have started even. He had no idea how to grow roses.
And he fell in love with some rose he saw.
Dr. Huey's. That was the variety that he fell in love with, cascading down this wooden fence from a doctor's house. 17-year-old.
And that was it.
That's it. He started. And he started collecting roses and trying to see what works and what doesn't work. And that's when the father said, son, why don't you start a rose garden?
And how did then this story and these wonderful photographs fall into your lap?
I think it was meant to be. My husband turned on the TV in the morning, which I do not appreciate because I like to listen to music to start my day on the right foot. But he turned on the TV that morning, and I was desperately trying to ignore what was going on TV, which I assumed would all be bad news. But then I heard this story about this rose garden and the photographs that remained, a letter that arrived at his doorstep 3 weeks later because he had moved around so much. Mr. Okada had moved as an evacuee.
Everybody had to get out.
Everybody had to get out. Everybody had to get out. And the story struck me so hard because of the beauty of the story and, like you said, the sadness of the story, as well as something like a letter that arrived that changed his life. He started healing thanks to this one letter from a visitor that had come religiously for 10 years. And thinking about the postman who tried to find Mr. Okada all over Japan to try to see where he was so he can get this letter. And this letter started a whole series of photographic exhibitions. Mr. Okada was asked to come and talk at these exhibitions. He didn't really want to talk about anything. He didn't want to even see the photographs at the beginning. But that talking, that expressing his regrets and his frustration and his anger and his sadness really helped him start healing. And he was also asked to go back to his garden to take photographs.
Can you?
Only people who used to reside in these the 20-kilometer no-go zone, if you live there, you're allowed to go back once every 4 months for 4 hours. The radiation is so high.
So from start to finish, mm-hmm. it was open for 50 years.
Yep. From the point that he falls in love with the rose at 17 all the way to when he lost it. And he will never be able to go back within his lifetime, nor his son's lifetime.
But you said that he did have one rose in a container that he grabbed and took with him?
Mm-hmm. Well, he went back later and he found a potted rose. And when he put the Geiger counter, it just went, you know, all the way into the red zone. So he shook off all the dirt, and he had pet bottles of water that he brought, poured the water over the plant as well as over the root, and the needle went down. So he brought back this plant and put it in his temporary home, and it's growing in a temporary home.
Okay, so now we got to put the hammer in. The garden is destroyed, I presume.
It has been abandoned. So what's happened, and I'm not a gardener, but you are, and so people who are listening to this program will also know how much care a rose takes. He had 700 varieties of them, so each one took different kinds of care. So the weeds have grown as tall as a man. The wild boar have started digging up everything. It's just poisoned wasteland.
Will the land ever be recovered in our understanding of time?
I don't think so.
Your book is wonderful, and it's probably the only reason that people outside of Japan even knew this garden existed, in one of the greatest twists of irony. And, you know, there's no end to the irony of this story. The World Federation of Roses was about to mm-hmm. make their first visit to the garden.
That's right. It was on the brink, literally. The World Federation of Roses members were supposed to come in May, and this disaster happened in March. And Mr. Okada was so looking forward to getting a really good critique of how his garden stands on world standards and where his garden would stand in, you know, among all the great gardens of the world. And he was so looking forward to this. This book, it's a hardcover book. I made sure that it is hardcover. I made sure that it is on really good paper. I wanted to make this a solid legacy of what this man had created. we're now working on a Rose project with a children's home. So he's starting to build a little garden with children who also have a very hurt heart, like he does. And he will show through rose growing that love takes a long time to establish, that affection does pay off because these roses will grow and within 5 years. And the effects will show that, you know, if these children learn how to give affection, they will get it back. And it's such a great lesson, you know, through roses. But what a great lesson that this man is trying to give to these children.
Well, that's a happy ending, and I'll take it. The book is The Rose Garden of Fukushima. Our guest has been Maya Moore. Maya, thank you for keeping this memory alive.
Thank you so much for having me, and I hope many people will read this book. It's really a beautiful book.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will discuss summertime growing and harvesting at 6 p.m. on Thursday, July 12th at Meadowbrook Farm in Abington Township, just outside of Philadelphia. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to a special summertime edition of You Bet Your Garden, featuring the most interesting interviews from past shows selected and introduced by our famed former producer Alexis Landis and production associate Brett Rader. Coming up next, amazing bees, peerless pawpaws, and puckery persimmons on a very special edition of You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And Smart Pots, makers of the Smart Pot and the Big Bag Bed, fabric containers for your performance container garden. Learn more about the features and benefits of the Smart Pot at smartpots.com. That's smartpots.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm producer Alexis Landis, helping Mike McGrath out today by introducing some of our favorite interviews from the last couple of years. Coming up, you'll hear Mike's conversation with Sam Droege, co-author of Bees, An Up-Close Look at Pollinators Around the World. This book will change the way you think of bees forever. Brett, did you get a chance to look at the slideshow we have up on the You Bet Your Garden page?
Yeah, I did. And the pictures are amazing. I mean, I never knew bees could have so many different colors and weird names. The orchid bee, which is actually purple. And there's one called the long-nosed sand lover. Who knew?
I know. I was really impressed. And I know our listeners will be too. After you listen, check out youbetyourgarden.org to see the slideshow.
Sam, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So just to set the stage, this is largely a picture book. You've got these amazing large-scale pictures of all these wonderful bees, not only from North America, but from all over the world. It seems bees exist on every continent where there's a flowering plant.
That's right, yep.
A lot of it is devoted to their beauty and their, let's face it, absolute weirdness.
Right.
And I also want to talk to you about the importance of native bees. But I'll start out by telling you that I am a fool for native bees. And every spring I save the lives of tens of thousands, maybe millions of native bees.
That's excellent. That's what we want to have for everyone doing.
Because you live and work in the D.C. area, you know that I'm on the air in D.C. as
right.
well as the public radio show. And every spring, all up and down the East Coast, especially from the D.C. area, people write me horrified about ground nesting bees. There's these bees all over their lawn, terrifying their children. And I've learned over the years to go, and yet isn't it amazing that no one's been stung?
That's right.
And you can almost see them pause in an email. And they go, oh, that's right. And I go, these are harmless, ground-nesting, native bees. They either don't have stingers, or if they have stingers, they're not going to use them. And they're solitary bees, but it's like South Philadelphia. They're solitary bees who live in a tight urban neighborhood.
Right.
And they're ephemeral. They'll be gone in a couple of weeks. Just leave them alone. And they'll overwhelm you with food and flowers later in the season.
Yeah. Most of those bees are one of two species of Calides or cellophane bees. And what people are seeing are actually the males guarding the nest. They're waiting for a virgin female to emerge so they can mate with her. And the females are very work-like. They would not know that they had bees nesting in their yards except for the fact that the males continue this swarm when males have no stings.
So it's
only
just like
females.
High school.
Well, pretty close. They look a little bit different, though.
So the males have no stingers.
Have no stingers. And the females, depending on the kind of bee, sometimes some bees are stingless. They'd have no sting any longer. And other times they, like many of our Andrena or digger bees, they can't actually penetrate our skin. So they may have a sting, but it's designed against other insects rather than against mammals or people like us.
I take a shortcut and tell people that if it's a native bee, that they're just not going to get stung.
Right. They're not guarding their nests, and the things that are stinging them are either wasps, like the paper wasps or hornets, or they're the non-native honeybee.
Right, exactly. I feel personally that most of the so-called bee sting deaths in the United States are due to yellow jackets.
That's true. In fact, most people call yellow jackets bees because they look more...
They look a little bit like
They look more like a bee because they're bright yellow and black rather than the... A honeybee is actually not quite the caricature of itself because it's brownish and people ignore it much more than the yellow jackets.
Now, before we get into these great native bees from around the world, honeybees.
Mm-hmm.
People have a hard time with the concept that these bees are non-native.
So most of the honeybee group is Asian. So if you go to the Himalayas or the Philippines or China, you'll have several species of honeybees that you can choose from. The European honeybee has always been there. Mostly it's been Mediterranean. And its kissing cousin, the African or Africanized honeybee, is just really a subspecies that differs a little bit because the whole Sahara is in between those populations. So those are anomalies. The bulk of honeybees come from Asia.
Now, the book itself is like, it's truly just a celebration of how crazy these things look. And the only problem is picking out your, like, 20 favorites.
Right.
So you suggested some, and it turns out all of these photos are in the public domain. People can share these and educate kids about bees around the world.
Yeah, they're on our Flickr site if you just look up our name, and there's probably going to be links on the website. And you can download the entire book, essentially, and print them out at any photo shop. They do great quality work.
Most of the bees you and I are going to discuss right now, we are going to put up on a slideshow on our website. And the first one, as I was going through the book when I first received it, that blew my mind is a bee from Australia called the Minute Baldy that I will tell you on the air looks like it was carved out of that great glow-in-the-dark plastic from the 1950s.
Yep. They're tiny. We're talking something that is maybe half or maybe a third the size of a grain of rice. So I think part of the book is all this diversity in sizes and shapes. And if you think of flowers, all the diversity of flowers, which we know, then there's an equal diversity in bees because they design these flowers. So in this case, little tiny flowers, little tiny bees, little tiny flowers in Australia have their own set of little tiny bees. Every continent has a similar set of minute bees that inhabit their lands.
I have been able to identify somewhere between 25 and 35 different native bees in my garden in Pennsylvania.
Well, I tell people that every one of their yards has the possibility of getting 100 different species of bees. They're constantly moving around looking for good food plants. And if you plant the right native plants in particular, they particularly like native plants, some are locked into certain kinds, you can attract bees almost anywhere. Downtown Philadelphia is totally fine for native bees if you have the right plantings.
Okay, next. This is crazy. The bottle green cuckoo bee from Madagascar.
Yeah.
What a a crazy looking bee with a science fiction face, looks like the fly in the original horror movie in the 50s.
Yep.
And tell us about cuckoo bees.
Well, about 20% of all bees around the world. So we know there's between 20 and 40,000 different kinds, but 20% of them don't carry pollen and nectar. They simply lay their egg in the nest of another bee species. They're often very specific as to whose nest they're going to lay in. And then over time, what happens is that the host egg and the parasitic egg hatch out, and then there's this little cage fight underground, usually, because that's where they nest. And the parasitic bee wins, eats all the stores, eats the dead baby, and then emerges from that nest. So that's their strategy.
And how did the name cuckoo be applied? Is that what the bird does?
Yeah, well, yeah. So we have, and actually our native cuckoo from North America does not do this, but the European cuckoo is a nest parasite of other birds. So it lays its eggs in the nests of other birds and, you know, does all kinds of crazy things to kick out the young and become the sole bird that the host bird feeds. So there was no, it seemed like a great analogy. So we often use these words that are from other species groups to this very strange world of insects. So cuckoo is one of them.
And again, there seem to be cuckoo bees on every continent. This seems to be a widely dispersed kind of trait.
That behavior of being a cuckoo evolves many, many different times in many different lineages. So you can go to any continent, even Hawaii, which had only one bee species ever populate it, but now there's 60, and some of those evolved the cuckoo aspects too.
The orchid bee. Come on. This thing looks like those things that would refuel a plane in flight. It's got this proboscis that it's as long as its body.
Right. And sometimes some of them are longer. The ones we pictured are only about as long. But it looks like what you would expect.
Oh, and you found this.
Yeah. So I was in central Guyana. It's the kind of thing you would, looking at a bee like that, you would expect it to pollinate orchids. It's so bright and shiny and metallic. But what's going on is that the ones that we caught are the males who are going to orchids specifically for gathering perfume. So the orchid provides a perfume. The male gathers the perfume, uses the perfume to attract the females. And then meanwhile, the females go back to these same orchids to gather just the nectar.
And again, this is not an unusual trait. There are many species of male bees that simply use the flowers to make themselves smell good.
Yes, and flowers are also producing scent so that bees can quickly find them in an environment that's actually, for a bee, is pretty tough to locate flowers. So it's that combination of color, and then scent is the secondary locator for, oh yeah, I like that particular flower, I need to find more. So they're using that to track things down.
And if I read this correctly, the orchid has evolved to actually stick pollen sacs onto the hind legs of the male bees as they leave and kind of send it as a little courier to the next orchid?
Yeah, so no orchid produces pollen that's useful or edible to bees. So most plants that are flowers have coated their pollen with all kinds of yummy, good bee food, but not orchids. They simply attract them with nectar or scent and then staple, in a way, this sack of pollen onto them so that it moves from orchid to orchid, and that's their MO.
And because this is, you bet your garden, because the other thing that we are crazy about with bees, right on a level with bees, is tomatoes. We have the now famous tomato-colored bee.
Right. Yeah, it actually just
from
shows
Chile.
Right. And it shows some of the color formations. And because tomatoes evolved in South America, it actually pollinates some of the tomato relatives that are in that part of Chile.
So why would it be the same color?
You know, the answer is, I don't know. This is a bee. Most of these bees have so many open-ended questions, and color is just a really big part of that. We almost know nothing about why bees are certain colors. Why are the orchids bees green? Who knows?
Yeah. So we talked about a bee with a long nose. Mm-hmm. Now, is this the bee with the longest nose, the long-nosed sand lover, also from Chile?
Yes, it probably is. It's another...
You need extra pages to get this guy's nose in the picture.
Right. It's fantastically long-faced. In fact, it doesn't even look like a bee. And then its tongue, which is folded underneath.
You've clearly Photoshopped this whole thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, you might suspect that. But this actually is pollinating flowers in the Atacama Desert, which is a super dry desert, and the flowers protect the nectar, which might evaporate, by making very long corollas. And so if you want to access that nectar, and the plant would then add a little pollen to you, you have to have a very long proboscis and face to get in there. And that, so that's what's going on. It's that coevolution thing.
The hemorrhoid digger.
Right.
That's mean. Who came up with that name?
Is
that
well, mean? if you look at the scientific name, it basically is repeating that name. And if you look at the bee, you'll see that the rear end is bright red, whereas the rest of the bee is some combination of greens and metallic greens and some dark colors and things like that. Why does it have a red end? I don't know. This happens several times. There's a bunch of red-budded bees throughout the world.
Another page that I marked is the brown-belted bumblebee, mm-hmm. which is a cool bee, and bumblebees in general are fascinating.
Right.
I think bumblebees are our great chance at getting children not to be afraid of bees because they're just so cute.
Yeah, and you can pet them in the garden.
And so cool. And this bee was collected on the White House lawn.
It was. It was part of an event where it was Take Your Children to Work Day. We were invited to show what government scientists do with insects and that everywhere, even the White House lawn, insects exist. And there was this bumblebee and we took its picture.
That's the other call we get is bumblebees and carpenter bees because mm-hmm. they're terrifying to people because they're chasing the
right.
people. And I go, well, you're near their nest or, you know, there's some reason that they're being afraid of you. But I said, have you noticed you haven't been stung? And they go, yeah. And I go, but maybe the bee, like, even headbutt you, right? And they go, yeah. And I go, that's all they got.
Right.
You know, there's nothing else. I mean, there's no ammo.
Yeah. So those are almost always male carpenter bees, which are, they're guarding a territory and in which several females might be nesting in your deck or something like that. And they are just little motion detectors. If you look at their head, it's mostly eye. And anything that moves, they come and investigate. They don't have a great handle on relative size. So to
they think
them,
they can take us.
Yeah. It's like, I better check this out. And so they'll move right up in front of you. And it looks like it's attacking. But the reality, they don't have a sting. And you can just grab them and show them to your cocktail guests. And you'll look like a true hero. Fists of iron.
Now, finally.
Okay.
And I'm not sure there's an easy answer to mm-hmm. this, or it may be very simple. What's the difference between a bee and a wasp?
Yeah, not easy. So one way to think about this is bees really are wasps. So they're just a vegan wasp. They eat pollen and nectar. And the wasps are all carnivores. But if you go in there and do all the phylogenetic work, you see that they are just nesting right in the middle of wasps. And so because you have bees that don't carry pollen and nectar, they have no reason to be all hairy. So you can't use the fact that they're hairy or not because the non-hairy cuckoo bees look like wasps. So the rest of all the other kinds of characters is they're just technical. And it's so difficult to tell apart some of the wasps to the similar-looking bees and vice versa that when we're processing specimens, I have many students who do this, we process all the wasps and all the bees so that I can look through them and make sure that we don't mix that up. So
right, because there's
really
bees
tell.
That look like flies. There's wasps that look like bees. There's flies that look like wasps
right.
and bees.
I get every month I get a set of what is this bee pictures, and because I've looked through all the bee books and whatnot, and it's actually is a flower fly that's mimicking a bee. So lots of fly pictures come my way too.
All right. Well, we could go on forever, but my producer is pounding on the studio wall. Sam Droege is a biologist for the Pawtuxent Wildlife Research Center. He is the co-author of a brand new book that is highly recommended called Bees, An Up-Close Look at Pollinators Around the World. It's published by Voyager Press. We're going to have lots of pictures up at our website, You Bet Your Garden. And Sam, thank you for your work. I love bees, and it's great to meet someone who's out there cataloging them and interacting with them every day.
Well, thank you, Mike. It's great to be here.
I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to a special summertime edition of You Bet Your Garden, featuring some of the most interesting interviews from past shows, selected and introduced by legendary producer Alexis Landis and production associate Brett Rader. Coming up next, the mysterious pawpaw and the puckery persimmon. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to a very special edition of You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by Smart Pots, makers of the Smart Pot and the Big Bag Bed, fabric containers for your performance container garden. Learn more about the features and benefits of the Smart Pot at smartpots.com. That's smartpots.com. And the Espoma Company,
offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. And we're in the stretch now. I'm producer Alexis Landis, looking back at some of our most engaging interviews with my fearless co-host, associate producer Brett Rader. Coming up, Mike talks with author Andrew Moore about a very uncommon but tasty fruit called the pawpaw. Pawpaw in Search of America's Forgotten Fruit highlights one of America's largest native fruits, which apparently tastes like a cross between a banana and a mango. Brett, have you ever tried a pawpaw?
I'm actually trying one right now. It's very tropical.
Hmm, interesting. Well, let's listen to this juicy interview.
Andrew, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Can you sing the pawpaw song?
Oh, boy. I'll kind of just give you the lyrics. It's, where, oh, where is little Andy way down yonder in the pawpaw patch? Picking up pawpaws, put them in your pocket. How's that for a rendition?
I thought it was picking up pawpaws, putting them in a basket.
See, that's one of the things I really like about the pawpaw is there's all this confusion, and everyone has their own version of the story, and that's one of them. That song, put them in your pocket, put them in your basket. If you've handled pawpaws, you know that putting them in a pocket is probably kind of not a good idea, especially with such a soft, pulpy fruit.
So let's drop back. There are two large Native American fruits, the persimmon and the pawpaw. When I was the editor of Organic Gardening magazine, our readers were enthralled by pawpaws, which is something you found throughout the country, that people who had tasted them when they were children, when they heard the word again, they went all crazy-eyed, right?
That's right, yeah. There's two kinds of people who are enthralled with them. There's the folks that remember them from their childhoods, you know, whether this was 40 or 70 years ago when they had their last taste of it. And then when someone mentions it, they get all, you know, wispy and they miss the fruit and they're excited about it. And then there's folks like myself who didn't grow up with it, didn't know about it. And when they're introduced to it, they find it incredible that such a unique, large, good-tasting fruit would be so unknown. And so folks like myself and so many others, they get really excited about it. And they do things like write a book about it.
As you did, In Search of the Pawpaw here. Now, this is a fruit that's hard to describe, let's be honest. I know it goes by a million different names. Back when I was the editor of Organic Gardening, most people called it the, quote, banana of the north. But in your book, you make clear that different trees will have fruits that will have radically different flavors. So first describe the leaves of these small trees, and then do your best to describe the fruit.
The first word that comes to mind for both the tree, the leaves, and the fruit is tropical. That word gets used a lot because I think it is so unique in flavor, the fruit, that we just need a word to say it's otherworldly. You know, it doesn't taste like Ohio. It tastes like tropical. And the leaves are among the longest and broadest of the eastern deciduous forest. Only some of the magnolias, broadleaf magnolias, are bigger. So it's a tropical-looking, broadleaf tree. The leaves are often a foot in length, if not longer. Just this really gorgeous look to it. And then the interesting thing about pawpaw and what sort of our generation is doing is we're taking them out of the woods and we're putting in prominent places in the landscape and in some cases in an agricultural setting. And when you put them in the full sun, they get this pyramidal shape, and they can get as tall as 30, 40 feet, and they can get to be this really big, monumental size, and they just have such a good shape and structure.
But
that's just the tree, not the fruit.
Right, but that's not their nature. One of the things that is going to be most appealing to our listeners is this is one of those rare fruits that grows in the understory, in the shade of larger trees, like black walnuts.
That's right. And, you know, mentioning black walnut, it's not bothered by growing with black walnut specifically. That's another good thing about it. But exactly right. Its native niche is the understory. That's where it's found. And you know, it will set fruit in the understory. So from a gardener's perspective, you can make it work in a shadier setting that another fruit tree wouldn't work. But again, what I sort of like about the pawpaw is it can kind of fit wherever you want it to. You can also put it in full sun, and it will also do well and produce even more fruit in full sun. So it's very flexible for the gardener in terms of, well, you know, where do you need this thing? And more than likely, it's going to do well in just about any condition.
And when you, quote, found your first pawpaw, when you went into the woods on your, quote, first pawpaw hunt, you did not see it first. You smelled it.
Yeah, I'm remembering back, and that may have been true. I saw the tree. I didn't see the fruit at first, and it hides behind those large tropical leaves that I was describing earlier. So it can be hard to see, but then you start to smell it when you're in the woods, especially if there's a good crop. And what a lot of folks do, because they can be sort of hard to spot, and if they're growing high up on the tree, is you just shake a pawpaw, the tree itself. And again, we mentioned they don't get very big in the woods, and so you can wrap your hand around it and shake it. And the ripe fruit, if it's ready, it'll fall. And it may fall on your head, it may roll down a hill, but you can shake it and get that fruit.
To discuss the taste, I'm going to read you some of your own words. Squeezing some pulp into my mouth, I sensed first the texture, like custard, smooth and delicate. Then the flavor, which was truly tropical, with hints of vanilla, caramel, and mango. Then I ate another one, and it tasted like a melon.
That was probably fruit gathered from a different couple trees. And that was sort of my bounty, as I had gathered everything from the woods that day and piled them in my shirt and took them out of the woods, and I set them down. And, of course, I'd lost track of what fruit came from where because I was full of excitement. That was, in fact, my first pawpaw experience. And so this is fruit likely from different trees. But also, as the fruit ripens, the flavor dramatically changes. It's certainly more mild, the greener it is. And then as it ripens and the skin will darken, it develops those caramel, brown sugar, very dark and sweet flavors. Even fruit from the same tree picked at a different time or left to ripen a little bit longer will taste different.
Now, the pawpaw is a fruit that ripens up for a period of like 30 days, at different times in different parts of the country, but generally as we're approaching or into fall, right?
That's right. Late summer, early fall, kind of with the mid-Atlantic being the middle of the pawpaw range, its ripening month more or less is the month of September. So, the further south you go, the earlier. And in states like Michigan, where there's native pawpaw stands as well as some small pawpaw farms, you have fruit pretty much all of October.
Now, if a gardener wants to grow a pawpaw, are they true to seed, or do you not know what you're going to get, like with apples?
They're like apples, though some folks may suggest that the genetic sort of likelihood of getting a good pawpaw from a good pawpaw fruit is higher, perhaps, than apple. They are not true to seed, though. So the only way to clonally propagate them is through grafting at this point.
Right, and that's probably the smarter money because the seed would take 8 years to grow to a size to produce fruit, right?
Right, and time is money. So, if there are a number of great nurseries that offer grafted pawpaw trees.
There are a couple plants like this, and I know they fascinate people. And this was something I honestly did not know about pawpaws, is they are not pollinated by bees. They are one of these plants whose flowers put out a carrion stench to attract flies.
That's right. Yeah, flies and beetles, the same insects that are attracted to carrion, decomposing flesh. And so it's led some writers to say that the pawpaw flower smells like rotting meat. Now, I've stuck my nose in many a pawpaw flower, and I've never detected rotting meat. But it's certainly a yeasty sort of scent. And in fact, in my research, I connected with a scent scientist who identified the scent as rising bread dough or red wine, which are, sort of yeasty, fermented odors that we actually find quite pleasant.
I was going to say, yeah. Well, but then again, when I have red wine open and the compost crock is too full, the fruit flies go for it like mad. So
there you go. Yeah, it's doing its job then.
We have to emphasize that the harvest period is really short. And the picking window is even shorter than that. This is like having a dairy farm. You can't go on vacation. I think one of the things you say that's a clue in your region, when you see goldenrod in the fields, the pawpaws are ripening up.
That's right. It's time to start looking for them. You know, if you're a wild harvester, and certainly in your orchard, it's time to check on them. But certainly if you have an orchard, you're thinking about them before you see the goldenrod. But
and when it's ripe, you just sit down, you bust it open, and you eat it with a spoon, and you spit out the seeds.
That's my way to go at it. I like to eat it fresh. It's my preferred way. You know, these things at this point anyway, they're hard to come by. And so when I get one, that's all I like to do is crack it open and eat it with a spoon.
I sense that during the writing of this book, you developed a pretty bad pawpaw habit.
I did, yes. You know, but every year, it seems, I'll confess to you, towards the end of pawpaw season, I've kind of had enough. I've had enough pawpaws.
But you say you filled the house with so many, the smell remains until Christmas.
Yeah, well, that may be some exaggeration, but it does linger. And, you know, my car has smelled like pawpaws for days.
I think Andy Moore needs a 12-step pawpaw group here. All right. I want to tell people that there are many other aspects to your book. You talk about all the county fairs, all the pawpaw celebrations around the country, how fruits have found their way into farmers' markets. You cover a lot of ground, and it's a very entertaining book. We recommend it highly. The name of the book is Pawpaw, In Search of America's Forgotten Fruit. The author is Pittsburgh's Andy Moore. It is published by Chelsea Green Publishing. All right, Andy, it's been great having you on You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Are persimmons puckery, or are they pleasingly pleasant? Producer Alexis Landis, please get us started with this week's astringent issue.
Well, Mike, we received quite a bit of feedback after you told a listener that wild persimmons tasted astringent and that named grafted varieties would taste much better. Michael, a quote longtime listener in northern Angelina County, Texas, titled his email response Persimmon Slander and wrote, "Native persimmons are very tasty if they are ripe enough to fall to the ground or be shaken easily off the tree. They are a favorite of raccoons. They clean the ground and climb the tree for more."
Raccoon gardening could be the next big trend. At least you'd grow a lot of sweet corn. Anyway, he wasn't the only conscientious objector. As many others noted, Lauren in Nashville wrote, "In my experience, the fruit of native persimmons has to experience frost before it can develop a more comfortable flavor."
Could that be true? You often say that things like carrots taste much sweeter after a frost.
Well, our fruit guy Lee Reich says that it's just a coincidence here. To have good flavor, he explains, persimmon fruits need to be dead ripe, and they ripen very late in the season, often around or after the time of the first frosts. Lee says that wild or cultivated, you need to be patient and wait until the color changes and the fruits are soft. Otherwise, the flavor, to quote Captain John Smith of the Jamestown Colony, will draw your mouth awry with torment.
We also heard from Fran in Northeast Oklahoma, who noted that our original persimmon caller, Loki, wanted to replicate the taste of fruits a friend had while traveling in Europe. She writes, "If Loki's friend enjoyed persimmons in Italy, they were probably Asian persimmons, species name Khaki, rather than the American kind known as Virginiana. Unfortunately," she continues, "Asian persimmons are unlikely to thrive in Loki's New Jersey climate, whereas the natives grow well into New England. In either case, as Mike noted, to get true deliciousness, you need grafted plants rather than seedlings." Fran continues, "We grow the grafted American variety Pro-K. The fruits ripen from early September through November, are the size of an apricot, and taste like apricot jam. We even spread some on toast, as well as eating them fresh. They are much tastier than the wild ones, which to me taste sweet but bland. P.S. I enjoyed Asian persimmons in Japan. Wish we could grow them here."
Okay, so there's actually four different kinds of persimmons the way I see it. The first are the wild Americans that grow naturally from Connecticut to Florida, as far west as Kansas, and reach 50 feet high at maturity. Most people don't think the fruits are very tasty, although the odd tree might produce enjoyable fruit, especially if you're a raccoon, I guess. Then there are what I'll call the cultured Americans, named varieties selected for better flavor and grafted onto dwarfing rootstocks so you can reach the fruits. Lee Reich raves about these types, but strongly suggests that people do some research so they can select the best variety for their specific climate, especially in the north, where you want to make sure you get ripe fruit before there's heavy snow.
Okay, that's two. Is there another American or two Asian types?
Well, there's only one Asian species, which many people just call cocky persimmons. But Lee divides them into two groups, astringent and non-astringent. Luckily, the so-called astringent ones only taste astringent if you pick them early. Like American persimmons, they have to stay on the tree until they feel soft. But you can pick the non-astringent types as soon as they color up, while they're still firm.
And is Oklahoma Fran correct that the Asian types need a warm climate?
In general, yes. If your winters are really cold, you definitely need an American, and one whose fruit will ripen up in your short season. Lee rates the Asians as being hardy in zone 7 to 10, which is roughly the lower third of the country and most of California. But in his latest book on the subject, Grow Fruit Naturally, he notes that some astringent Asians are hardy down to zone 5. I asked him about this directly, and he says that Loki should be able to find an astringent Asian variety that will survive and ripen in New Jersey.
And are Asian persimmons really that much more flavorful?
Well, they're definitely bigger and juicier fruits. Lee describes their flavor as sweet, but not as rich as the best of the cultivated American varieties. If you live in a warmish climb, you can grow both and decide for yourself. Most of the Asians require a mild winter, but lack of a chill doesn't bother the American types.
So what else would a gardener need to know?
Well, these plants have a long taproot, so they need a deep planting hole. And some varieties require a separate male plant to get fruit, while some are self-fruitful. So again, you need to do good research before you buy your trees. Well, that sure was some interesting information about persimmons, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to particularly pucker my persimmons if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore, as long as you include your location, at garden@whyy.org. Oh, and please include your location. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where nobody cares about your location, but where you will find answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Rich Banowitz and Larissa Sapko keep our website puckered up. Our own native bee, Alexis Landis, produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our editor is Al Pawpaw Banks. Our associate producer is radioactive Brett Rader. I'm taking my first real break in 18 years, Mike McGrath. But I'll be back to see you again next week.